I assume that most of you went to Giffre's talk in the morning about tensor networks. I'm going to give a quick recap of some of the things Giffre said, just like a few minute thing about reminder of what are tensor networks and what is Mera. And I'm going to spend most of my time talking about how to interpret Mera as a quantum circuit and a real space R3 transformation, which should give you an intuition of why Mera is built the way it is and why it may make sense as an ansatz. And then I'll explain in a bit more detail something Giffre very quickly went through, which is structure of two-point correlators and structure of entanglement in a mirror. And I'll also briefly talk about efficient computation of expectation values, but I will not talk about optimization of a mirror. So the starting point is that somebody has given me a Hamiltonian, and I have optimized a mirror state to be as close to the ground state of that Hamiltonian as possible, and then I'm going to talk about the properties of that mirror. If you want to know more about optimization, as apparently some people do, I'm very willing to answer questions later on. Unless otherwise mentioned, everything I say is from one of these papers. If you read those, you'll get a very good idea of what Mera is and why you should care, and also how to deal with it numerically if you so wish. So, oh, and feel free to interrupt me as much as possible. I assume most people here did not know much about tensor networks before this morning. So I'm hoping this is going to be pedagogical and not like a research talk. A very quick recap of the graphical notation we are using. So tensor is represented by some kind of blob, and every leg, as I call them, every one of these sticks represents an index of that blob. And if I join two of them together, those two indices are identified and summed over. So these networks consist of small tensors and a lot of summations, contractions over indices. And there's just a small example, but Giffre went through this stuff already. So ask me if this is not clear. If any diagram at any point is not perfectly clear, ask me, but I will not spend more time on that. The point of tensor networks is that, in general, when you have a quantum many-body system with the local Hilbert space having dimension d and having n sites, then you can represent the wave function graphically like this, and that has d to the power of n elements, which you just cannot deal with numerically, for instance. It's an ugly beast. But if you are interested in ground states of local Hamiltonians, or maybe low excited states, then typically they have a very specific structure. They have limited entanglement and so forth, all this area law stuff that Giffre talked about, which makes it reasonable to assume that some decomposition of this generic state into a form like this could work out. Sure.
I'm confused about the transposition in the upper right expression.
Uh-huh.
Where, can you see that from the triangle to where they are?
Yes. So for instance, here, that index of this tensor and that index of this tensor are the same,
yeah.
which is the same situation as in here, where like I'm contracting the rows of A with the rows of A, meaning the columns of A transpose. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So, I was confused today. So you're considering this local components and... for example, the one-dimensional spin situation. So mm-hmm. Isn't it the ground state just 0, 0, 0, 0?
No, not necessarily. Like, depends on the Hamiltonian. Like, say you have a system that wants to be anti-ferromagnetic or something like this. Or you could have very highly entangled states if your local Hamiltonian pushes you in that direction.
So... those circles, does that reflect that people, when they do MPS, usually it's symmetric under exchange of the two bonds and the bond dimension types?
Mm-hmm.
Is that usually the case?
Not necessarily. What is more typical the case is that if you have a translation invariant system, as you often have, then all these circles are the same. Generically, they don't have to be. Yeah.
In the non-translation invariant case, you might want to vary what chi is,
Yeah, you could vary chi and you could vary
It's basically like the number of coefficients. If you do a fit decomposition, you want to keep track of how
many
non-zero entries are. That's
okay,
like what's setting the
dimension. Not quite sure how common it is to have a flip symmetry like this as well. Maybe up to like gauge factors, but probably not explicitly. So saying that I can decompose my generic state in something like this is a trivial statement if I don't say anything about the number of the dimension of that index. So if I do the summation, how many values do I sum over? I call that chi or bond dimension. And the trick here really is to design these networks in such a way that chi does not depend on system size and is bounded. If I let chi grow exponentially in system size, I can represent any state like this in whatever network I want. So that's really, really the, all of the magic here. So this gives us efficient storage. Instead of having to store d to the power of n elements, we can store something that scales as some polynomial of chi, and maybe it's linear in n. Maybe if you have a translation invariant system, it could be constant in n, and so forth.
So one thing I'm learning is if you give yourself the freedom to take chi as big as you want, do you expect that at some point you'll cover the entire space of space?
Yes, you will. You also have to let chi change if you change system size, but yeah. It's always the case, no matter what your network is. So we have efficient storage. We also have efficient computation that Kiefer talked about. And maybe more interestingly, because I assume most people here are not very much into numerics, you can really see the structure of these states explicitly. Like the entanglement structure is really like a nearest neighbor structure here, and there's something hierarchical on the scale here, which I'll explain in a moment. But that's one conceptual beauty of tensor networks. So on to Mera. So that's a Mera. It doesn't have to look exactly like that, but the point here is that Mera is a tensor network where you have layers like these that are similar to each other. Don't necessarily have to have the same tensors, but similar in structure. And the tensors, individual tensors, have these properties. So this is called isometricity, and this is just unitarity. I call these things disentanglers, which the name will become clear in a moment. There's some key numbers about the computational efficiency. They change a bit if you... So I could have this be... I could have all the tensors be different, or I could say that's translation invariant, so that doesn't... The tensors here are the same as they are here. Or I could also say that maybe it's scale invariant and all the layers are the same, and then these numbers change a bit. Mostly, I'm going to be assuming here that I have a scale invariant Mera, just for simplicity, but also because that's where Mera really shines. That's where you really make use of the nice properties of Mera. So in that case, this would continue infinitely far that way and that way and also upwards. But for most of the arguments that I make, they are also valid for, say, you could imagine periodic boundary conditions or whatever. I haven't really specified in the pictures. So Mera is typically a good ansatz for scale invariant state with the characteristic properties that two-point correlators decay polynomially instead of exponentially. And entanglement entropy of a block of sites in the lattice scales logarithmically in the size of that block. And at the end, like by the end of this talk, my goal is to have shown you that all Mera states typically have these properties. And these are typical properties of ground states of gapless Hamiltonians. So that gives you a plausibility argument, which is then verified by numerics. Almost everything I say is mainly verified by numerics, not by analytical proofs, that Mera is almost always a good idea for representing the ground state of a local Hamiltonian. So that was my quick recap of what Gifford told you in the morning. Is everybody on board at this point knows what these diagrams are and what roughly a Mera is. Oh, and I should mention that this can be done in higher dimensions, at least in principle. Numerically speaking, computational cost is going to start growing as some much, much higher power of chi, and it gets computationally really tricky, but conceptually stuff works in higher dimensions as well. But I will be talking only in 1D. So, next up, I'm planning on giving you two different ways of looking at a Mera that should give you an idea of why do we look at a tensor network of this form? Like, why did somebody just draw a random collection of blobs and draw lines between them? And it should also give you physical intuition for what kind of states the mirror states are. So the first way is to see mirror as a quantum circuit. So I mentioned that all of these tensors are either unitaries, so two sides go to two sides in some unitary rotation of the two-side Hilbert space, or isometries, which do a unitary rotation, and then they do some kind of projection and throw some of the Hilbert space out and keep only chi, a dimension chi. And the observation here is that all of these isometries can actually be seen as unitaries, two unitaries, contracted with some constant vector. And if we just look at the mirror and think of all the isometries in this way, and move those zeros around a bit, we realize that this can be seen as a quantum circuit that is unitary, and it takes in a product state that has zero entanglement anywhere. Does this specifically structured time evolution in some, this is not physical time, this is like quantum circuit time here. And as an output, it gives you some entangled state that tries to be the ground state of a local Hamiltonian that you've been given. The ansatz is that this ground state can be prepared by such a circuit. And the structure of the circuit here is such that if you look at, for instance, say, take these two parts of the product state. They go through this gate. Usually it's some generic unitary that generates a lot of entanglement. Then one of the outputs goes this way, and the other one goes that way, and the influence of one spreads over to this region, and the influence of the other spreads over to this region. And now the entanglement that was created over here is entanglement between like this part of the lattice and some partially overlapping another large part of the lattice. So over here we have created entanglement that is like long length scale entanglement. Whereas if you look at something like this, this also takes in two inputs and entangles them, presumably, unless you really pick your unitary specifically not to entangle, like you could pick trivial unitaries, but then it's no fun. And the entanglement created over here spreads out to cover a part of the lattice like this. So it creates entanglement on that length scale. So really, you should view mirror as a unitary circuit that prepares states with this hierarchical structure of entanglement at all different length scales. And if you have a scale invariant mirror, for instance, then the type of entanglement that is created is the same at all different length scales. And these different layers of the network correspond to different length scales in your system, which you'll see that theme appearing again and again and again. Does that seem plausible? Does that seem understandable? So if you think the ground state of whatever state you're trying to represent by a mirror should have this kind of entanglement structure, then you're probably good making the ansatz that your state is a mirror.
So isn't it a bit anti-intuitive that you first introduce the long scale entanglement and then you introduce shorter length scale entanglement if you follow time that way? I mean, I see how it works, but is there a physical interpretation of this, or is it just a trick?
I don't really see much physical intuition because the time here is not. There's when I say first, it's in this time of the quantum circuit that doesn't physically really mean much. I don't know, like, could you imagine doing it the other way around?
Yeah, I think the other
way around
makes more sense.
Yeah, I think so.
Because you start from short distances, or destroy the short distance, and you keep moving.
Yeah.
Actually, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of run this the other way and think of it as a coarse graining that first removes short-range entanglement and then moves on upwards from there. Maybe you'll prefer that image of the mirror. So that's going to be the next thing, that this is one way of intuitively grasping what a mirror is. And
so yeah, I'm presuming there are many different structures like the one you're drawing there.
Mm-hmm.
Who decides on that?
Who decides on that?
Yes.
You decide on based on features like which one is computationally more efficient. Maybe you can calculate some things a bit more easily from other things. Like, I'm going to later on show a slightly different mirror, which is just very good for calculating two-point correlators. Otherwise, maybe a bit more cumbersome than this. So it's really, for conceptual purposes, it doesn't matter. For numerical purposes, you pick based on what you're doing.
Okay. So basically, there's a fixed structure, and then you optimize over what you put on each box.
Yeah, so before you start doing anything numerically, you choose, like, maybe I would, for instance, want my isometries these things to take in three sites instead of two sites. That would be perfectly valid, nothing wrong with it. So that you have to choose yourself. And then during the optimization, you can change the individual tensor elements of each of these tensors to match your purpose, typically to minimize the energy.
So yeah, I want to just make sure that answer. So the first step is always you want to solve a specific physics problem. You have the Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. According to that, you're going to somehow find the right mirror associated to that.
Yes.
That's the first step. We don't talk about that stage because...
Because it's a long discussion and it's kind of technical.
And the right, so I've always only seen like three legs or four legs. Theoretically, we could go five, six, seven more legs too.
Yeah. It's probably computationally a bad idea, because the larger your individual tensors are, probably the larger your computational cost. But you could, yeah.
But would there be, I mean, is there something which says like, I can replace like seven legs by two rows of threes or something? Or would there be like an intrinsic advantage on having like a seven legs?
Generically, you couldn't replace, if you have a big tensor that takes in, say one of these isometry takes in seven legs and outputs one, then if you say that decomposes as smaller gates, then that's another ansatz that you're making on the structure of that. So
it really is a different state with a different entanglement structure.
It could be, yes.
Okay.
And then, yeah, physically, if you optimize correctly, and if this is a good ansatz, you'll probably get roughly the same state back. But maybe your individual gates don't match up necessarily. Like one gate doesn't really match up with.
But so you're saying that generically, you have found it's enough to have four and three to approximate states.
Yes.
Well enough.
Yes.
Right.
And
that's kind of like how you're sort of saying that the Hamiltonians, that this is a good, you know, network for preparing your ground states are like two body local or something along those lines. Like if I had a Hamiltonian that was three body local or something, I might want to use isometries or disentanglers that involve three pairs.
Maybe, but once you even
not
if
an intuition.
Even if you have a three body local Hamiltonian, then once you've done one step of coarse graining, you kind of lose the differentiation between is it two sites or three sites at the UV level. So I'm guessing it wouldn't make that much of a difference, but it could help maybe.
Also,
I've tried.
In practice, when you do before you, you know, to do the optimization, you look at a small, like you take the original Hamiltonian, like coarse grain it into some smaller dimensional operator, and
mm-hmm.
then you do some kind of exact diagonalization on that,
mm-hmm.
and then you know that ground state is some state in a very small Hilbert space, which
mm-hmm.
is like the, you know, IR,
mm-hmm.
and then you try to build up from the IR to the UV, right? Is that?
Yeah, and you kind of like because the way you coarse grain the Hamiltonian depends on your mirror, like you coarse grain with the mirror, so you kind of
right.
like go up and you optimize at the top, and then you go back down, and then you go back up, and you keep sweeping back and forth. But
yeah,
you have the
this
right
process of like, how do I choose the initial mirror circuit that gives me a nice Hamiltonian at the top layer?
Yeah,
that confuses me a bit. Maybe you should go on.
Maybe I'll talk about the optimization things later on. They are very interesting and very important. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting conceptually too. Because in practice, if you want to find a ground state of some local Hamiltonian, you start in the IR. Or like you start with some small dimensional
yeah.
Hilbert space and then diagonalize the Hamiltonian and
right.
build up from
yeah.
that.
Here the trick is that the scale transformation depends on your state. So
right,
that
right.
kind of
so
mixes
it's
things up.
Weird.
But, yeah. Did I answer all the questions? I feel like I skipped something. Okay. That's mirrors quantum circuit. Next, let's forget for a moment about mirrors and ansatz, and let's think about real space RG. So for some reason, somebody's given you a state, which is, say, the ground state of a local Hamiltonian. And now you would like to coarse grain that. You would like to have a description of this state at a coarse grain level where you lose some of the fine details and you look at it at a high length scale. So what do you do? Well, a reasonable idea is to take some local block of the state of your system and somehow group these together into one effective site at the next length scale. And this you can do by an isometric tensor, which does some kind of unitary rotation here, and then it throws some of the things away, which relies on the idea that there's some kind of local correlations happening here, which can be rotated away by the unitary or stored in the unitary. And that allows you to keep the bond dimension here to be, I mean, you could trivially do this if that one dimension was chi-squared, but you want to keep it lower because you don't want to store all of the details of your state, you only want the coarse grain features. And that sounds like a reasonable idea. you could optimize for these tensors such that the error you cause in your truncation when you cut that bond dimension is as small as possible. But then you think about it for a moment and you realize that there's an issue here. Say, imagine your state is the product state of a lot of bell pairs, just bell pairs between local nearest neighbors, represented here by these red things. Now, if there's a bell state here, that's fine, it goes in there, you can rotate it, you can store it in here, and output just a product state. You can like get rid of that local correlation as you should, because that's short-range physics. That shouldn't be carried over to the next length scale. But if you have a similar bell pair here, which just happens to be between two of your blocks, which you just have to choose them somehow, then these coarse grainers here cannot do anything about it, and this carries over to the next length scale and becomes a bell pair at the next length scale, which is both numerically a bad idea, because that puts a strain on that bond dimension. Now you have to keep a bit larger part of the Hilbert space there to be able to store this without causing errors. And it's also conceptually wrong, because this is supposed to be a coarse grain description that has glossed over all the short range details like nearest neighbor bell pairs. And a way to fix this is to introduce what we call here disentanglers. So unitaries that operate on the boundaries of the blocks and can, one way of putting it is, to store these kinds of local correlations so that if you run this evolution the other way around, these can like generate it when need be. Or you could say that they do a unitary rotation here and change this correlated entangled bell pair into some product state, then which can then be coarse-grained away, and it's not showing up at the next length scale anymore. And this is called entanglement renormalization. And the E and the R here are the E and the R in MERA, multiscale entanglement renormalization ensembles. So that's a way of doing coarse-graining on a lattice that removes all local correlations like these when you move to the next length scale. I see some very skeptical faces. if you keep repeating this, you do one step of coarse graining, why not do another? You get an even more like longer length scale description of the system. And you realize that you're building a mirror here. So what you're the question of how do I choose these tensors to be able to do this coarse graining of the given state with as small error as possible is really the same question of how do I maximize the overlap between this state and a mirror. So in other words, if you think that your original state should probably be you should be able to coarse graining with this kind of coarse graining procedure, then you should also be able to represent it as a mirror state. And the other way around, the fact that this works, let's keep the logic this way around.
What's the large green block on top?
Oh yeah, sorry, I didn't mention that. So here, say you have a finite system like I've drawn here. At some point you just coarse grain this so much that the whole system consists only of a few sites. You can't really coarse grain any further. And then you just do, say, exact diagonalization, and you get this one final top tensor there, which is like the really, really far IR description of the system. If this could also be a translation invariant or scale invariant system, and then it would never reach the top, but yeah, that's what it is.
If you flow to like nothing, I mean, do you have to have some specific flow to be able to do, I guess you kind of answered that, but there are flows which flow to nothing, for instance, and then you can't really do that.
By nothing, do you mean a product state? Like a really trivial state?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually kind of what's happening here. Like you can say that this top tensor here implements one final step of coarse graining, after which the whole state is just completely trivial. You can imagine there being one final length scale here consisting of one leg, which is one dimension one. So it's like a totally trivial state at that point. Sure.
Can the disentanglers be different unitaries at different sites?
Yeah, they can. If you have a translation invariant system, then probably makes sense to have them all the same, but in principle, yeah, they can be.
Okay.
And you can have things like maybe your system has an explicit boundary somewhere, and then there are different the other boundary and translation where in the middle. Yeah, you can do a lot of things with that. So that's another perspective of why we are looking at networks like this. Why does a mirror look like look the way it does? Are there any? So maybe I should say that. Now I'm going to go on to discuss how I coarse grain operators. This is for states, and then I'm going to start talking about efficient computation and all these structural properties. So this is like this is the end of one part of the talk where I tried to give you motivation for why mirror is the way it is. Do you have any questions? Nope. Okay. So just for further purposes, let's take one layer of this network, which implements one step of coarse graining, and call it U. It's just some operator that takes in a bunch of stuff from here and outputs a coarse grained version up top. Now that was for states. You of course also want to coarse grain operators. So here you have some local operator, which operates on three sites, could be something else too. And then you just apply U and U dagger on the two different sides. I have not made a I was just being lazy, so I didn't differentiate between complex conjugates in the diagrammatic notation, but you probably know which one, what needs to be complex conjugated. And this looks kind of bad at first, because you have a local operator here, and then there's this massive network that doesn't look fun at all. But now you start using the unitarity properties of your mirror tensors. So recall that these are unitary, so they cancel with their complex conjugates. And similarly, these are isometric, so they also cancel with their complex conjugates. They do not cancel here, because this O is blocking the way. But now we see that if you do one step of entanglement renormalization on a local operator, at least you get back a local operator. So here we've gone from a three-site operator to a three-site operator. Maybe it goes from two sites to three sites. Or if you start with a large operator, like six sites or something, it's going to go down to three sites. There's some characteristic notion of like locality, how many sites are they typically wide, the operators. But locality is maintained. It never grows unbounded. And this is, you're going to see in a moment why this is important for computational efficiency, but this is like a really, really crucial feature of a mirror. You could almost define a mirror as a quantum, a tensor network that can be thought of as a quantum circuit that has this property of mapping locals into locals. Not quite, I mean, you'd have to be more precise, but this really is like, I would say, the defining property of why mirror is built the way it is, that you get these, what we call bounded causal cones. So this thing here represents the operator O at the next length scale. We call A here the ascending super operator. It takes operators from the previous length scale to the next length scale, the coarse grained version for all.
Can I ask
Suppose
I want to study a system of fermions in one plus one dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of this mirror network in like the Hamiltonian, I'm really approximating grad C2 is actually a state in terms of spin variables, sonic pieces. So I might want to try to like represent the fermionic operator by some Joule-Wigner transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the operator has some like long range support over, it's like, you know, something times a domain wall creation operator. It's like, very, you know, it's not exactly local in those variables. Is there any like simple property that like gets coarse grained to in the parent network? Does it, yeah, I mean, does it stay like completely supported, this domain wall creation thing, or is there any kind of?
It's a good question. I do not know the answer. I would imagine so, because you could also. You could also deal with the fermionic system in the first place. You could just do this for fermions.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't get the same answer. It's just, you know, one representation. I think for a DMRG, for instance, like this Joule-Wigner representation is usually used to tackle the fermionic system.
Yeah, I would expect so, because, I mean, you could do the mapping, Joule-Wigner mapping, do a step of entanglement renormalization, and you'd get something, and you could go the other way around, like do the fermion coarse graining on the fermions, and then do the Joule-Wigner transformation, and we'd assume that this would, there should be a relation, but I don't actually know.
Okay.
It's a good question.
Can we see this map A as a quantum operation? Like, is it positive and linear and so on?
Yeah, it's absolutely linear. It's also positive definite. Yeah. They also call these Mera quantum channels. I think this was a name that was used by some people. Yeah. So, briefly about efficient computation of expectation values. Again, not going to go into the details of numerics, but this is really important for understanding why this whole thing works. So, say you have some operator O, which is here this red blob, and then you want to take the expectation value of that O on a Mera state. So you have the Mera and its complex conjugate, and you just sandwich the operator in between. And that, say you have periodic boundary conditions or something, so this network doesn't have any open indices and contracts into a scalar, and you just need to find out what is that scalar. And now, if you think about the quantum circuit picture that we had earlier, then there's a time evolution going this way, and really, this gate, for instance, should not be able to affect what happens here at all. Like, the influence of that gate just doesn't reach over here. So we say that there's a causal cone of these local sites here, which I've drawn here. And from the quantum circuit point of view, you would argue that only these gates have any relevance for what the state, the Mera state, is over here. Everything else should be irrelevant for our purposes. And saying what I said previously, that local operators get mapped into local operators, is, you'll see in a moment, is equivalent to the statement that this causal cone has bounded width when you go up the network. It doesn't grow, like it's two sites over here, it's two sites over here, and it's two sites over here. It doesn't grow. So if you, sure. And
everything else outside that collapses the identity, and that's why it's.
Yes, exactly. So now you start using the property that these are unitaries and those are isometries, and you do the same thing we did earlier with the single coarse graining step of an operator, and you realize that everything outside the causal cone really cancels. That's just like two ways of looking at the causal cone, the quantum circuit picture, or this way of looking at it. And now this looks manageable, and when you think about it for a moment, you realize that over here, you have the ascending superoperator, the A from the previous slide, acting on this thing. And then you have the same operator, again, acting on the output of the previous. And again, the ascending superoperator, just like log n powers of the ascending superoperator. I say log n. N here is the system size. Because by the time you've done log n coarse graining steps, every coarse graining step cuts the size of the system by some constant factor, cuts it by 2, or here by 3. This is ternary Mera, so all the isometry is taken 3, output 1. So after log 3 n layers, you've coarse grained the whole system to a handful of sites, and you're done. So evaluating this expectation value just boils down to doing log n evaluations of the ascending superoperator, which can be done at constant cost, some polynomial power, some power of chi, the bond dimension, and then you're done. So this is, numerically speaking, you could say that this is why we choose the unitarity and isometricity properties of the tensors, so that we can efficiently do numerics, because the whole network would be completely, you can do anything with the whole network if you would have to start dealing with this thing tensor by tensor. But this makes it numerically tractable. And also conceptually, what you're just doing here is you're taking your local operator, you're doing scale transformations on it by this entanglement renormalization, and then once you get to the level where your state is trivial, you just evaluate the expectation value there, and you're done. And related to your question and some other questions about how do you choose your tensors in a Mera, this, it doesn't, it's not really obvious from here, but this is really, once I show you that this can be done efficiently, it's clear to see that you can also optimize pretty efficiently. Because imagine that operator over there is just like one local part of your Hamiltonian, one of the local terms. And so you can evaluate the energy efficiently, and then you just have to choose each of these in such a way that this thing is minimized, turns into a minimization problem for things you know you can calculate. Everybody good? Yep. So now onwards to to what I call structural properties of the mirror. So what I by structural, I mean that these are properties that follow mainly from the structure of the mirror. You could choose your tensors at random, for instance, and these would hold for your generic mirror. You can, unless you specifically tune your mirror not to obey these properties, it will obey these properties. Giffre already went through this quickly in the morning, so this is about how two-point correlators scale. Turns out they scale polynomially, as they should if we want to represent ground states of gapless Hamiltonians. But I'm going to quickly go through the argument again. Maybe I'll be quick about it and stop me if something's not clear, because Giffre already talked about this in the morning. So we have two operators, one over there, one over there. You have the mirror on both sides, so this is just the expectation value, that's the correlator. This block here is a type of reduced density matrix, but for the purposes of this talk, you can just think of it as representing the network from here on up and here on down. It doesn't matter really what it is, as long as we know it, it's something we can handle. And I say that these two are separated by L sites, and I want to know how this correlator depends on that L. Again, there's a causal cone, and this is a specialty of the ternary mirror, where you have a 3-to-1 mapping with the isometries. You can choose the location of these operators in such a way that this causal cone is really, really simple. Seems kind of like cheating that, like, if I would just move this by one side over here, suddenly my causal cone would be much larger. The analysis just goes through much more easily in this case, so that's why I'm doing it here. But it turns out if you numerically do this and you move these operators a bit, you're going to get the same result. It doesn't, even though it looks like I did a very special choice, it doesn't matter for the end result, numerically speaking. It's just easier to do the analysis in this case. So the mirror, even though it looks kind of, it doesn't treat all the sites on the same footing, so it looks like it could be not translationally invariant. If your Hamiltonian is translationally invariant, you find that the optimized mirror is to high accuracy also translationally invariant, even though it's not clear from the structure. So everything outside the causal cones just cancels, just like before, and you're left with a network like this. And now imagine for a moment that these operators that you have, the red blobs, are eigenoperators of the ascending superoperator, which in this case takes a very simple form here. So I just say that this is that. That's what I mean by eigenoperator. If they are not, you can just expand them in the basis of eigenoperators. And here is a bit of algebra, which I'll probably not walk you through. But the point is, this expression here is just a rewriting of this diagram. And the point is, you have the ascending superoperator here, and you have it over here, and you have it over here. And you have to raise this ascending superoperator to a power of log L, where L is the separation between these two sites. And by the time when you've done that, by that time, these two operators become nearest neighbors at this length scale. And then it's just a matter of contracting it with this, what I call the reduced density matrix. And you just work it out. Because these are eigenoperators, it becomes really simple, and blah, 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 blah. And you end up with an expression like that. So this two-point correlator between two of the eigenoperators is just L to the power of scaling dimensions. These here are the scaling dimensions of these operators. And then there's some constant which doesn't depend on L in any way. Depends on this thing and what the operator is, but doesn't depend on L. So this shows you that at least for this specific choice of site, correlators decay polynomially in a scaling invariant mirror. Note here that I assume that all of my layers in the mirror are the same, so it's a scaling invariant mirror. And moreover, it's kind of nice to see that if you think about the continuum limit of your system, because it's a scaling invariant system, you expect that to be a CFT. And if you have a CFT and you have scaling operators, then you write the two-point correlator of scaling operators like this. So it really, there's a nice match between what happens on the lattice and what happens in the continuum.
When you go to a CFT, the dimensions have to be the same, because otherwise,
how does
that, like, in the limit, how does that happen?
That's stored in the CIG, right?
Sorry? The CIJ.
Yeah. Yeah.
The zero, the dimensions are the same. That's what the special component.
Exactly. So CIJ should be a zero.
Yeah.
But I mean, does that then come?
That's going to be sorted out.
Yeah, so you're just going to find that this thing over here is zero. Although what I've shown you so far does not make it obvious. Mm-hmm. I think
yeah, that's my
information
about
the actual system is going to be stored in the density matrix.
Yeah, because rho depends on what exactly is the physics you're dealing with. But it's a good point. That really comes, like the zero comes from this factor over here. Sure.
So if... L is pretty big, then it seems like since we're iterating this map A a lot of times, it should be almost just a projector onto its principal eigenvector. So I think that like for generic phi, unless it has zero support on that, it's always going to be projected onto the same thing, and it will always be giving you the same value of delta.
I mean, yeah, there's a single eigenoperator of the ascending superoperator with eigenvalue 1, which is identity.
Oh, there is.
Yeah. So if you just replace phi, that's a good point. But if you replace phi with identity, you're going to get back the identity, which is just the isometricity property of the isometries.
So to avoid that, you want phi to be traceless or something, so it has no component.
No, it's fine. Just like everything else is going to. Going to decay polynomially, and like if you keep raising a to higher powers, it's this correlation function is going to go down exactly as shown here. But if you choose both of your phis to be the identity, then that scaling dimension is zero, and that scaling dimension is zero, and this just becomes a constant. So that's the only case where it does not decay.
Okay. So you said you only get conformal measures if you go to continuous version? Because I remember there was some finite version on the...
Do you mean like local scale transformations?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a bit of a different story. So you could... that's just... Like, when I'm doing scale transformations here, I'm always doing a global scale transformation. You could also do local scale transformations. And it actually gets quite a bit more tricky, but it works out. But the only statement I really wanted to make here is that the form of correlators we get here matches what you would want to see from a CFT perspective. Because just on a physical level, if you have a scaling variant lattice system, you have the critical point of some lattice model, the continuum would be expected to be described by some CFT. Nicely as well, you can find out the scaling dimensions of your different scaling operators in the CFT just by diagonalizing this. You get all the deltas from there, so you can also access universal information directly from the ascending superoperator. So that's two-point correlators. So that's my structural property number one, and this is really what should be happening because this is what is observed in ground states of gapless Hamiltonians. So that's one argument why MERA is a good idea for such states. Here's the other one.
Are you going to show us how to do four-point correlators?
You could.
And I want to see a conformal block extension.
Yeah, you can do that. You can actually get conformal. Yeah, okay, I see.
Don't let me derail
you. Yeah, you could do that, but let's not go there. A more simple thing would be doing three-point correlators and getting the OPE coefficients, yeah. And that works out. That works out. You can actually get the OPE coefficients in several ways. You can also take two of your scaling operators and just do a step of coarse graining that maps them into one operator. And from there, you can get the OPE coefficients. Right. You have to be tricky with normalization and so forth, but it works out at the end. It's kind of neat. I really like this conceptual aspect of how these things you would expect from the continuum come up in exactly the ways, like conceptually the way you would want them to. The other structural property that I want to tell you about, which is also something Gifford briefly mentioned, is the scaling of entanglement entropy. So take your lattice, separate some part, and ask how badly is this part entangled with the rest of the lattice. And by how badly, I mean what's the entanglement entropy. And there's a generic statement, which I wish I had time to prove, but I don't, about any tensor network, regardless of any properties of any unitarity or whatsoever, that whenever you can make a cut through your tensor network that separates this part from the rest of the lattice, whatever the cut is, that cut gives you an upper bound for how much entanglement can there be between A and its complement. If you saw Matthew Hedrick's talk earlier, I think last week, he had this argument of like strings of entanglement and whatnot, kind of resembles that. Anyway, so any cut through any tensor network gives you such a bound, and of course you take the minimal cut to get the strictest bound. And in an MPS, for instance, which is this string-like tensor network that you saw a lot in the morning, that tells you that entanglement entropy of a block doesn't depend on the block size. It's constant. Here, the minimal cut is such that you start from the boundary and you keep going up from both sides until you get to the level, the depth of the network that corresponds to length scales where this is just to one or two sides. All of A is corresponding to one or two sides. And every time you cross one of these layers, you have to cut one leg here and another leg over there. So you get 2 times logarithm of the size of A times a factor coming from your bond dimension. And that's a strict upper bound for how much entanglement entropy you can have. That's an upper bound. Typically, if you do this for states you find when you optimize for ground states, then you find that this upper bound is saturated. And also, if you pick at random your tensors, then this upper bound is also saturated. For a long time, this was just a numerical, very strong numerical observation. There's also some nice analytic work related to the question of random tensors, that is from January this year by Patrick Hayden and others, which you can check if you want.
Is it very hard to prove this?
To prove the upper bound?
Yeah.
No. It would be, if I had 5 more minutes, I could. It's really simple. It could be like an exercise for you. It's really nice. So that's another property. So yeah, I should emphasize that the property that entanglement entropy of a block like this scales logarithmically in the size of this block is something very typical, again, of ground states of gapless Hamiltonians. So this is another structural feature that really matches what we claim Mira to be good for.
Dumb question. Why did you go? Did you have to go to the level where it's only two? I mean, you could have like cut, just gone vertically or sorry, horizontally earlier.
Oh yes, maybe I didn't explain this well. By a minimal cut, I mean the number of, like, I could have gone this way.
Yeah.
But then I would have cut a lot of legs.
Oh.
So this factor here, yeah, sorry, I didn't explain that really well. This factor here is the number of legs that I have to cut. And this comes from each of the legs, the log of chi. So I just try to find the curve that cuts as few legs as I...
It's like an algebra.
Yeah, that's, I'm going to show you a root again, like, yeah.
So A is the baseline, right? The number, size of A here.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the same of the number of nodes in the area there.
This size of A here, that size of A is just the number of physical sites that I have over here. Yeah, the physical, at the physical level, yes. Is that good? Seems so. Oh yeah, I actually have time for this, I thought I wouldn't. Just a brief mention. Typically, this is just something that really, for me, illustrates the how the different length scales relate, how the different depth, the different layers in the network relate to different length scales. So usually if you have a finite correlation length, so you're not dealing with a critical scale invariant system, you would be better off using an MPS or something else. But conceptually it works out pretty nicely even if you use a mirror. So imagine you have a correlation length. Then what you find naturally when you create your mirror is that after a few steps, your state cosgrains to a trivial product state. And this happens at a length scale that corresponds to the correlation length. So psi here is the correlation length. Or the other way around, if you just enforce, say you have a scale invariant mirror and at some point you just decide that you're going to cap it off like this, that creates like an effective correlation length in your system. And if you think about what I said just on the previous slide about the entanglement entropy, Then now, if I want to separate off this part of the lattice from the rest of the lattice, I can do a cut like this, and then moving over here is free. I don't have to cut any indices because the state is a product state. These are like indices of one dimension one. They contribute nothing to entanglement entropy. So by the time you reach block size that is larger than the correlation length, the minimal cut and thus the entanglement entropy of the block becomes independent of block size, which is again what you would expect of gap systems. So you can really nicely see how the structure of this having this correlation length comes about in the network.
Yeah. And if you mirror the critical system, yeah, you're getting this log of the correlation length type
correction
constant term. Yeah,
yes.
So the entanglement.
Yes, exactly. And then when you get closer and closer to the critical point, this cap of the tensor network is gonna go upwards and upwards and upwards, and when you hit the critical point, it's gonna go up to infinity.
So for example, if you put the CFD at a finite temperature, you would see something like that.
It would get to like a boring, trivial, completely mixed state at some point, right? Are you asking how that would show up in the tensor network?
Right.
Yeah, you could do that. There's actually, that's one of the things that I would have liked to talk about, but I don't have time. Mirror for thermal states, mm-hmm. And you can see a structure kind of like this where it doesn't turn into a product state, but it turns into some simple layer of tensors that gives you the thermal properties of it, and then there's like another mirror on the other side that gives you the other side of the density matrix. It's a really hand-wavy explanation, but
it's like making a thermal field double.
It's very, that's what people want to see. They want to see it as a thermal field double. I could show you a picture and it would be nice, but.
Yeah, I mean, you need to see a transition from like area to volume or something like that, right? Increasing the number of cuts. Because that's the change in the time.
Yeah. I wonder how that.
I mean, you need to start having many, many more paths.
Yeah. So that would mean that you would either there would happen something really interesting would happen at like inside the black hole, or you would really run out of one dimension in your mirror. Yeah. Maybe we should talk about that afterwards, because now I'm feeling like if I say more, I may tell you lies. Sorry, I don't have this clear in my head. A similar thing for the two-point correlators. There's an argument which I didn't make, which is much more hand-wavy than the one I gave you, which roughly says that two-point correlators decay exponentially according to a length of what people like to call a geodesic. So that just means if I have an operator over here and if I have an operator over here, find the shortest path through the network to connect these, counting how many legs you have to go through. And if you have a generic state, like if you choose your tensors at random, then you expect your two-point correlators to decay according to this. And this is another argument that you can use for figuring out how correlators should decay. It's not as robust, but whatever. Anyway, you can see nicely that if I have an operator over here and an operator over here, this is like roughly the length of the correlation length. It doesn't care that the geometry ends over here, but if I put them farther away, then the shortest path just starts to wiggle around at the top of the network, which looks a lot like what happens with an NPS, where you get an exponential decay of two-point correlators. So you can see a transition from polynomial decay at correlation at lengths shorter than the correlation length, and then exponential decay at like beyond that, which you can just read off from the diagrams.
So Here you're in this network with this triangle with three legs in. You're only disentangling the legs that belong to different triangles, and so there's only disentanglers between. So every three legs, two get disentangled and one doesn't.
Yeah, so you're asking why doesn't this get disentangled?
What's the physical approximation you're making when you're doing?
So I am, I'm removing, like say at this length scale, this here takes care of entanglement between these two sides, but if there's entanglement between this side and that side, then there's no disentanglement to take care of that. This is gonna get transferred over on the next length scale, but it's going to be dealt with there because there it becomes nearest neighbor. Was that, did I understand correctly what you mean?
I think so.
Yeah. Very briefly, I avoided talking about holography. One, because it's not my expertise. Two, because there's going to be a lot about it tomorrow. So tomorrow's discussion session is going to be titled, I think, Holography in Tensor Networks or something like this. But just to give you an idea of where this whole thing came from, of why would there ever be a connection between the two, here's just the redrawing of a mirror for a system with periodic boundary conditions. So here you have your physical system, and then the network goes into the bulk. And originally, Brian Swingle started thinking, could this be seen as a time slice of ADS3? Because, for instance, if I look at the entropy of this part with respect to the rest, you want to make this minimal cut that I talked about. That's very much like Ryutaka Yanagi. Or if you think about this decay of correlators, you can think of them as like being exponential decay in distance through the bulk. And then, and also there's this connection between the z direction in the Poincaré patch of an ADS time slice corresponding to coarse grading, and here having the same idea of going further in the network corresponding to coarse grading the network further. And then there's more recent claims and ideas about maybe this isn't quite the right picture. Maybe we should really think of the mirror not representing a time slice of ADS3, but representing its kinematic space, representing the kinematic space is the space of geodesics. And there the main argument starts from the kinematic space being Decida and the causal structure of a mirror matching the causal structure of Decida in a way that makes much more sense than if you think of it as an ADS time slice. And then the argument goes on from there. But really, if you're interested in this stuff, you should go to tomorrow's discussion session. I will be going. There's a few other things just to mention that could have been fun if I had time. One is thermal mirror, so you can represent thermal states in a mirror, or with a mirror, or a mirror-like construction. That's really fun and nice, and like you mentioned, people want to see the thermal field double there. There's 2D mirror, which is a topic in itself. There's continuous mirror that Giffrey Vidal gave a talk about yesterday, which is trying to push these ideas from the lattice to the continuum. This is very much like in development happening right now. And there's also a branching mirror, which would take you beyond logarithmic corrections of the area law. So the area law in 1D would be having constant entanglement entropy. A mirror state can support logarithmically scaling entangled entropy. Branching mirror could go way, way beyond that, which could be useful in higher dimensions where you have, say, systems with Fermi surfaces where this kind of scaling of entanglement entropy is found. And yeah, but I am out of time. So a quick summary. I hope I've convinced you. I hope I've just made it clear to you, told you that mirror is a class of tensor network states that can be thought of as quantum circuits that take a product state and introduce this hierarchical structure of entanglement, or as results of doing real space RG that removes all local correlations. And I hope I've also convinced you that it's a good ansatz, or it would be expected for it to be a good ansatz, and numerics shows that it actually is, for ground states of gapless local Hamiltonians based on it supporting these very characteristic properties of such states, entanglement entropy scaling logarithmically and two-point correlators going down polynomially, and that it has interesting connections to holography, which I assume is the reason most people here are listening to me talk. That's all. Questions? More questions?
I think we have an RG flow between one CFT and another CFT. How do you think about representing that? And like in the middle, you have to spend more time in geometry of the of these layers.
You wouldn't have to change the graph of the network, the structure of the network, but you would probably so say you would want to, for instance, insert an operator at some point and see it flow to another CFT.
Right, but that operator would be inserted on a whole layer because it's like a relevant deformation of the CFT, which means it's everywhere at some point if you want. So in particular, there is a large, you know, range of energies where it's not scale invariant. That's why I'm asking whether you should be more in the geometry because it cannot be represented, you know.
I mean, yeah, you can. You'd probably have to like give up scale invariance for some layers before it reached again. But this actually happens with the scale invariant mirror. In practice, what you do is you have a few layers. If you start from a lattice model, so you take the Ising model and you put it at the critical point, then you have a few layers of the mirror which are not yet scale invariant because you have to like kind of clean up the lattice model to really find out the universal part of it, and then you reach the scale invariant level, and from that point on, the network is self-similar when you go up.
So if you assume that the network is self-similar to start with, you have some kind of numerical problem or something?
Yeah, you wouldn't be finding a good ground state if you were trying to, if you would impose that and minimize for the energy.
So just the naive way of finding this, I mean, what it should look like, you start off with some random choice of I mean, not random, but I mean, I guess some semi-random choice of network, and then you, like, what you compute correlate. I mean, you compute like the correlation function of h, or the expectation value of h, and then you see if I change it, it gets smaller. And
yeah, there's actually a way of doing an optimal choice. If you want to minimize the energy, you look at the network that contracts into the scalar that is the energy expectation value, and if I take one of the tensors there. So say that's your local Hamiltonian term. If you'd ask me how do I choose that tensor over there to minimize this energy, there would be a simple answer to it in terms of contracting the rest of the network and doing a singular value decomposition. Now what you need to do, because the optimal choice for that depends on all the other tensors, and maybe you want to impose many of the tensors to be the same, is you have to do an iterative thing where you like take the optimal choice for that and update it all over the network and take an optimal choice for one of the other tensors. So you, by optimal choice, I mean minimizing the energy as best as you can. And you have to like sweep up and down and sideways depending on the symmetries and so forth. But hopefully at some point you'll converge to the ground state.
And dynamics, is there any notion of possibility of doing dynamics with all of this?
You can try. You can take your mirror state and you can just apply your time evolution operator. You can do a Suzuki Trotter decomposition consists of small local pieces. And you can apply it and you can try to make that the new state you get into the form of a mirror. But typically what you get when you do time evolution is that you lose these properties of having area law of entanglement or even logarithmic correction of the area law. So it just has to fail at some point.
So the problem is not conceptual, it's computational. I mean, since we can represent anything we want with mirror, the only thing we're saying is that at some point we're getting to a state which is not efficiently represented anymore.
Meaning your bond dimension is too large.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still represent it as a mirror.
Yeah. I mean, you can represent any state with a mirror if you are free to choose your bond dimension to be as high as you want. I'm not sure if people have actually done time evolution. I know that with MPS people have done and are doing it, and you can keep it up for some time. Like you can do some time evolution, it's not going to break apart immediately, but you know that at some point it must fail. I don't know if similar kinds of numerics have been done with mirror, but I don't see a reason why they could not be done.
Do you typically get something like an error correcting code? So think of like the highest level there, maybe that's one qubit on top.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the bottom, do you need all sides if you want to like access this qubit, or will it sit somehow copies of it, like in a code?
Mm. So like kind of like a redundancy of the description of the
yeah.
top level qubit at the bottom level?
I mean, I'm asking a bit because in this holographic picture you have this relation to
code. Yeah. I do not know. It's a very good question, but I simply do not know. Does Kifre know?
You can actually use Meta to codify the target code. You can describe the target code, and the very top of the target code of the Meta, you'll have the logical qubit. So the answer is yes.
But not random circuits, I guess. Not random errors.
I don't know about the random case.
So suppose instead of starting with a Hamiltonian, you started with a CFT and you wanted to construct it using Mera, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The various data, like these delta sub i's and so on. Do you do that directly from the delta sub i's and whatnot? Do you use with the corresponding transformation that you called
no.
early A?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
just go that way and never do any optimization?
I don't know. I don't think anybody's done it. I've been actually thinking about this like on my spare time when I'm not actually getting work done. Like questions of and could you do it maybe the other way around? Of like choose different kinds of tensors over here and try to look for what are all the different kinds of sets of eigenvalues you could get for them that would be consistent with having a CFT, like what are the operators you need to have, and you need to have a conformal towers and so forth. So yeah, I see why you're asking. It sounds like maybe something like this could be done, but I can't say for sure.
Okay.
Anybody else? If no, then I'll let you go. I'm 10 minutes over time already.